Sam and Dave, I thank you, and I do thank you for your fine company. Welcome back to Coast AM, coming to you live from Coast Toronto Affiliate Talk Radio, AM 640. All right, when we come back, we are going to talk about Mokele Mbembe. What is Mokele Mbembe? Well, this is supposedly a, it's reputed to be an amphibious dinosaur-like creature. Supposedly 35 feet long, up to 35 feet long. It's got brownish gray skin, a long, flexible neck. And according to legend, it lives in caves, it digs in riverbanks, it feeds on elephants, hippos, and crocodiles. Could Mokele Mbembe be a brontosaurus, a dinosaur thought to have become extinct 65 million years ago? We'll find out when we speak with a real live dinosaur hunter, Dr. Bill Gibbons, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Stay with us. Explore cryptozoologist William Gibbons. Dr. William Gibbons has traveled to remote corners of the world in search of strange and unknown creatures. But Bill's heart is in Africa, where monstrous dinosaur-like creatures are still rumored to inhabit the vast swamps of the Congo Basin. Bill provides a fascinating insight into several expeditions that have ventured forth in search of suspected living dinosaurs, included several of his own. No armchair explorer, Bill also details several other incredible creatures that by all accounts should have been extinct eons ago, yet are still encountered today by astonished eyewitnesses in the 21st century. And these accounts can be read in Mokele Mbembe, Mystery Beast of the Congo Basin, and Missionaries and Monsters. Bill Gibbons, welcome to Coast AM. How are you?
Good to be with you again, old friend.
Yes, it's been a while. How are you?
I'm great, thank you. How are you, Richard?
Very well. So, how many times, I've lost track, Bill, how many times, how many expeditions have you taken to Cameroon and the Congo Basin, let's call it, the Congo Basin? How many times have you been back there?
Seven so far. The first two were to the Congo, which we found very, very difficult to work in for various reasons. The rest of the expeditions, the other five, we have ventured into Cameroon, but one right on the border with Cameroon and the Congo. But we found that the expeditions to Cameroon have been by far the most rewarding when it comes to information and finding evidence on the existence of Mokele Mbembe.
Now, I gave kind of a thumbnail sketch of what this creature looks like, but most of what we know about this elusive creature comes from the locals, the inhabitants in that area, which happen to be pygmies, correct?
That's correct. Well, there's several different tribal groups that live along the river systems, the Sanga River, the Shah River, the Obangi River, the Bumba and Ngoko Rivers. You know, they all sort of tend to interlink at various places. And the diversity among the different tribal groups is quite remarkable. I mean, they're all different. They speak different tribal languages. They have different social structures and so on. But by and large, in spite of the fact that they have even different names for Mokele Mbembe, that's the more popular name for it, they all describe exactly the same kind of animal, including its habitat and its food supply and its behavior and everything else, which we find very intriguing. Because if Mokele Mbembe was a cultural reconstruction or a mythical animal, it would normally just be confined to one particular ethnic or cultural group. But it seems that the animal is well known throughout the general Congo Basin area.
And when the comparison is made, or when Mokele Mbembe is described as closely resembling what we used to call a brontosaurus, and now I think they changed the name. Now it's a apatosaurus.
Correct.
How are the locals describing this? And how? I mean, are they drawing it, or are they? Are you showing them models of different dinosaurs? How are they identifying it as closely resembling an apatosaurus?
Okay. Well, in a nutshell, what we do is we tend to use a comparative analysis approach. In other words, we start showing the local people pictures of African animals that they would know: hippos, elephants, crocodiles, even monkeys, gorillas, chimpanzees. All of those that they pick out fairly easily and give their actual names of them. Then we show them pictures of North American animals they wouldn't be familiar with, like a moose or a bear or even a skunk, and they say, no, we don't know those animals. Those animals don't live around here. Then we show them pictures of dinosaurs, you know, reconstructed pictures of dinosaurs. And about 90%, or in fact, I'd say about 97 or 98% of the dinosaur illustrations are completely rejected. They don't know what a T-Rex is. They don't know what most of the, there's like an Ankylosaurus, for example, or a Spinosaurus and so on. But on every occasion, almost without fail, those natives who have actually observed a Mokele Mbembe pick out the Apatosaurus or any one of the long-necked sauropod dinosaurs as being representative of the animals that they know of that they sometimes encounter in the rivers and also in the swamps.
And they haven't just seen this creature from afar. I mean, they have encountered it. Sometimes they have hunted it and killed it. Sometimes members of their tribe have been killed by it. Correct?
Correct. I know that that most people are familiar with the Mokele Mbembe story if they've been following this. At around about 1959 or 1960, some pygmies that lived around the Lake Tele region. That's right in the Likawala swamps and the what we call French Congo. They used to fish daily in the lake, and I've been to Lake Tele. It's very rich in fish. And one or two Mokele Mbembes would enter the lake daily through a series of water channels called malebos that merge the lake with the swamp. Now, in spite of the fact they were very much afraid of these animals, they erected a stake barrier, cut some trees down, and put some sharpened stakes as a barrier along the entrance to the lake. And when they observed one of the animals trying to break through the barrier, they speared it to death. And the story goes that they cut the animal, once it was dead, into slices, and they ate some of the animals. They cooked and ate some of the animal's flesh as a sort of a victory feast. But the story goes that those who participated in the eating of this Mokele Mbembe's flesh died shortly after. Now, that could be for any number of reasons. Now, forest-dwelling pygmies, especially the real insular groups like the Bangombe pygmies around Lake Tele, up until that time had very, very little contact with the outside world. And they would live only about 25 or 35 years, and not very long. I mean, pygmy women get married at the age of 12, and by the time they're 14, they've got a couple of kids. So their lifespan is very short. So they could have died from natural causes, or they could have died from some sort of a toxin that may be present in the animal's flesh. Now, let me say also, another story came to me from in Cameroon. Around about 1950, one of these animals died, presumably of natural causes, near a village in the Sanaga River. That's in northern Cameroon. And the villagers cut it into slices, and again, ate the meat, but there was no reports of anything unpleasant happening when they ate the flesh of the animal. So there's a couple of reports of Mokele Mbembes being killed or being eaten by the locals. And in the Congo, you see mythifications beginning to develop around the animals. In the Congo, they have a lot of superstition surrounding Mokele Mbembes because it's such an aggressive animal. It's almost treated like a god to them, and they don't like discussing it, especially to white outsiders, where, again, with the cultural differences in Cameroon, we find that eyewitnesses are quite happy to talk to us about the animal and even take us to locations where they've seen it on occasion.
Well, how is it that an animal this large, and again, reports are up to 35 feet in length, this is a creature so large, I mean, it's the actual name means able to stem the flow of rivers.
Right.
How is it that an animal like this could be unobserved or not seen by outsiders, not videotaped, no photographic evidence? How is that possible?
Well, it's a very simple reason. Now, what's so interesting about that question is that there's, we think we're dealing with two different types of Mokele Mbembe. The one in the Congo is described as being 15 to 30 feet in length. Body about the size, average of a hippo, with a neck about 6 feet in length and four stubby legs. Now, these animals are semi-aquatic and spend their time in the deep rivers and in the swamps, and they emerge from the water to feed mainly on leaves and fruits that grow along the sides of the rivers or in swamp pools. Now, when they detect a sound that may be foreign to them, say an outboard engine of a canoe, they will immediately go underwater, where, according to the natives, they can stay for quite long periods of time. I mean, they can hide underwater like a hippo for hours. Now, in Cameroon, where the animals are described as being very much bigger, and we're talking 40 to 60 feet in length, a head height of plus 20 feet, armored body, you know, rigid spines. I mean, if ever there was a dragon in Africa, this is it. But again, if you've actually been there, you will understand how animals that big can hide. See, when people ask questions like, well, why haven't we seen them? They get the impression that it's like Jurassic Park, where these animals are moving around in large herds, walking around on dry land. They are, in fact, solitary animals. They've only been observed in maybe two or three on occasion, like two adults and a calf or one female and a calf. But by and large, when people observe Mokiling Bembes, they are solitary, they're by themselves, they're usually feeding, and if they're approached by a canoe or they hear an outboard engine, they will immediately go underwater. Because remember, in the wet season, those rivers can get 40 or 50 feet deep. So an animal with a head height of, say, from 10 to even 20 feet can hide quite comfortably under the rivers for hours on end. In fact, can even hide in swamp pools without being detected because they are always under cover. And those swamp pools are very, very difficult to penetrate, especially when they go quite far inland. So even if it's a very large animal, it still could be difficult to detect, because in 2012, when we were penetrating an unexplored region in the Upper Char River, a herd of elephants was walking along the side of the river behind the thick underbrush, and we didn't even know they were there. They were so quiet until we spooked a young elephant, and it ran around trumpeting, and that's when the rest of the elephants realized that we were there and kicked up a bit of a fuss. Thankfully, the river was too deep for them to come in after us. But yeah, animals that big can hide themselves very well in that kind of dense undergrowth, so it's quite a challenge to find them.
Dr. William Gibbons is with us, the author of Mokiling Bembes, Mystery Beast of the Congo Basin and Missionaries and Monsters, and he has been to the Congo Basin on seven separate expeditions in search of this elusive creature. Have witnesses actually seen Mokiling Bembes taking down an elephant or a hippo?
We've had reports of Mokiling Bembes battling hippos, but these reports are relatively rare because, in spite of the fact that the conditions for hippos are ideal in the Char River, hippos are completely absent because we're told Mokiling Bembes will chase them away. Now, that's an interesting point that the natives have, because they are both semi-aquatic animals. They both eat river plants. But there would be some sort of a competition going on between the two of them. Now, what we find intriguing about these reports is, and you probably know this, hippos kill more people in Africa than any other animal. I mean, a male hippo can bite a man or a woman in half. And so they can be very dangerous if approached. So if a Mokiling Bembes can kill hippos and elephants with the greatest of ease, then it's certainly an animal that we need to keep a respectful distance of if we're ever fortunate enough to observe one, which I hope will be soon. But natives have reported finding hippos dead on sandbanks that have been, literally smashed to bits, and they can tell that this was a Mokiling Bembes because it uses its heavy tail to lash out whether it's a canoe full of people or whether it's a hippo. And when elephants are crossing the river, the elephants tend not to swim too often, but when they cross the river in Mokiling Bembes territory, we've had at least two reports where Mokiling Bembes have emerged from the river to menace elephants and chase them away. And we have one report from the Congo where a Mokiling Bembes was engaged in an epic battle with a large crocodile, but it still killed the crocodile by a tail lashing. So these reports are just absolutely fascinating.
Now, you've been to the Congo Basin seven times. How close have you come to actually catching a glimpse of this creature?
Well, a couple of times, actually. like I said, in the Congo, it was hard to get information out of the local people because of their superstitions, and we only had a handful of people did come forward to give us information and tell us where we were, you know, the best chances would be to see these animals. But in Cameroon, we've made the most progress. Because in 2003, for example, I went with a fellow explorer from Saskatchewan called Brian Sass. And we were told by the village people of in a place called Lengwe that there was a narrow channel in the Jar River between an island. They call it the Forbidden Zone or Swamp Island, the Island of Swamp, and the Congo side of the river, where Mokele Mbembe's had been seen, because they used to string their fishing nets across that channel, and when they'd go back to check the nets, they would find the nets torn up, as if something had just, you know, pushed its way through the nets and just tore them up. And so we went to that channel with a couple of the village people who were paddling the canoe on either side, and they were very afraid of this area, and they didn't really want to take us there. As you know, one trip was enough, so we had to keep hiring different boat people to take us to this one channel. On the last day we were there, remember, we're sitting in a dugout wooden canoe, and the two people paddling are standing up, one at the front, one at the back. And then one day they started shouting excitedly and pointing ahead and saying that there was a large animal crossing the river ahead of us, probably about 20 feet away. Now, our Cameroonian companion, Pierre Sima, who is our translator, stood up in the canoe and spotted something moving across the river, and the look of shock on his face was enough to tell us he'd seen something extraordinary. By the time we'd panned our cameras in that direction, the sound of human voices carrying across the water alerted this creature, and it put his head under the water. Now, when we got back to the bank and we managed to calm our guides down and get Pierre to translate, they saw a head, a very large head, shaped something like an American football, come out of the water attached to a long neck, and they could see the back of the animal just under the water, and it was moving slowly along against a very strong current, as if it was walking on the bottom. And the sound of our voices alerted the animal and put its head under the water, and that's when our guides had enough and got us back to the shore. Now, Pierre explained a little further that this animal was definitely walking along the bottom of the river. And that river at the time was 20 feet deep. Okay, this was not a crocodile, it wasn't a snake, it wasn't a lizard, because the strength of the current would have affected its passage and would have swept the animal towards us. Now, that was in 2003. 2004, Brian Sass went back with a biologist called Peter Beach, who's one of our team members, and they found, as the river had water had gone down because of the dry season, they found these huge elephant-like footprints, and they measured these footprints. They went quite deep into the mud. Now, they looked elephant-like, but Pierre Sima is an elephant tracker, and he could tell that these were footprints made by a very large animal, but not an elephant, something as big as an elephant.
All right, Bill, I've got to jump in here. We're going to take a time out, come back, and we'll continue to delve further into this mysterious beast of the Congo Basin, Mokele Mbembe, with a real-life dinosaur hunter, Dr. Bill Gibbons, with us. Here's Eddie Floyd taking us into the break, and Knock on Wood. You're listening to Coast AM. My name is Richard Serrett. Stay a while. Sly and the Family Stone, Family Affair. And Sly recently reportedly was awarded $5 million from a judge in California. Sly, I believe, had sued a former manager and was, up until recently, or maybe still is, was living in a camper or an RV in a neighborhood in Los Angeles, and no doubt can put that $5 million to good use. Sly and the Family Stone. All right, I really want to encourage you to join Coast to Coast AM's George Norrie for dynamic discussions on paranormal phenomena, conspiracies, and all things unexplained on his TV show Beyond Belief. The next episode is August the 17th. It's called Besieged by Bigfoot, featuring Christine Parker. A strange howl in the dead of night changed one family's life forever. From that moment on, the Parker family has been besieged by Bigfoot-type creatures living near their home. Beyond Belief TV with George Norrie. Sign up and start watching episodes right now at beyondbelief.com. When we come back, more of my conversation with Dr. Bill Gibbons in search of Mokele Mbembe right here on Coast to Coast AM. Explorer, cryptozoologist, author Bill Gibbons is with us. The books are Mokele Mbembe, Mystery Beast of the Congo Basin, and Missionaries and Monsters. And we're talking about this elusive creature in the Congo Basin, Mokele Mbembe, anywhere from 15 to 40 feet long, and a long, skinny neck, able to stem the flow of rivers. That gives you an idea of its size, and is described by the local tribespeople in that region as being a very fearsome creature that will go after hippos, elephants, crocodiles, you name it. Now, Bill, are you convinced at this point that what we're dealing with here is in fact an apatosaurus or a brontosaurus and not some just previously, you know, unknown creature?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. You know, I think, Bob, what I believe at this point is that we're dealing with an extraordinary, large, territorial, aggressive animal that matches the description of a sauropod dinosaur. But, you know, I cannot, in all honesty, put my hand on my heart and say, Mokele Mbembe is a living dinosaur. It certainly sounds like one. But, you know, it may be a major new species, that is completely new to science. And that, to me, is equally as exciting.
All right. If it is, however, an apatosaurus, I mean, how can we explain how a creature supposedly which died off 65 million years ago somehow has survived enough breeding pairs to make it a viable population?
Well, I had that discussion many times with the late Dr. Roy Mackall, a name who's probably familiar to you, who led the modern-day search for Mokele Mbembe back in the 1980s. And he is of the opinion, as many open-minded scientists I've spoken to, is that in an area that has remained environmentally stable, like the Congo Basin, for such a long period of time, where there's been no mountain building episodes, no glaciation, no major upheavals, no earthquakes and so on, but has just stayed as primitive today as it was then, it should not surprise us that a relic species, or i.e. a living dinosaur, has survived happily in that area where it doesn't have any real competition, where its food supply grows in abundance, and where the human population is very, very thin and non-existent in many parts of that area.
Well, give us a sense of this, the Congo Basin, the terrain. You mentioned a number of rivers, but it's also a vast swampland. I mean, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of acres, correct?
Correct. We're talking initially of about 55,000 square miles of up to 70,000 square miles in the outer reaches of seasonally inundated swamp. It's a vast, vast area. You are constantly under assault from all kinds of stinging and biting insects. I mean, I've had malaria in the past. You can come down with things like amoebic dysentery and various skin infections. It's just a very hostile area to spend any length of time in. I mean, we've gotten much better at staying there for longer periods over time. But it's really like looking for a moving needle in a haystack, if I can put it that way, which is why we depend on the help of the local tribespeople, especially the Pygmies. The Pygmies, by the way, are incredible little people. They will go deep, deep into the forest and the swamps hunting and gathering where many of the other African groups just don't go. And that's why they describe to us animals that we know of. And, of course, many of the major discoveries made in this area over the past 100 years, whether it's flora or fauna, have been made with the help of the Pygmies, and the Okapi being one example. And every new discovery has been exactly as described by the Pygmies. So they are very trustworthy little people. And I'm convinced that, you know, we're going to be successful one day soon with their help.
And when are you going back next?
We are hoping to go back in January. That's at the end of the wet season. The water level is getting low. Now, I should mention that my French colleague, a fellow called Michel Ballot, he lives in Nice, he has been out to Cameroon close to a dozen times already, started going out in 2004, inspired by my own expeditions. And he's a lucky man. He's married to a beautiful woman from Cameroon. He just jumps on a plane in Paris. He's in Yaoundé, the capital city of Cameroon, in 7 or 8 hours. Has lots of good contacts in the country. So he and I are now working closely together, and he has found some amazing, amazing footprints in the mud and sandbanks right up in a very remote area that we are currently working on, which we feel will yield tremendous results. But getting back in January, it all depends on funding, and raising funding for expeditions like this is never easy.
How do you fund it?
Well, we tend to just scrimp and scrape and just put barely enough funding together. Now, people have suggested to us, why don't you do crowdfunding? It's a great idea, but the thing is, there are so many good, worthy causes on crowdfunding websites like Kickstarter and Indiegogo and so on, that we wouldn't really want to take money away from other good causes out there. So what we've done this time is we've put together something called the Mokele Mbembe Handbook, which is 62 pages. It's in PDF or Word. It can be emailed to anybody that wants a copy. It's packed with photographs, charts, drawings, maps, all the real meat and potatoes information you want on Mokele Mbembe. And it's available for $5. And if anyone wants to send me $5 by PayPal, they'll get a PDF or Word copy of the Mokele Mbembe Handbook, emailed straight back to them.
And how do they get that?
Well, my domestic email address is wgibbons, G-I-B-B-O-N-S, at Shaw, S-H-A-W, .ca. That's also a link to my PayPal account. Now, my YouTube account, which is Crypto Hunt, CrypTo, Crypto, and then Hunt, H-U-N-T, has about 5 videos on there relating to Mokele Mbembe and other mystery animals. And all you have to do is go on there and give me a thumbs up or subscribe. Because I think with YouTube, once you get 1,000 subscribers, then you can start making a little bit of money. And any monies that we make out of the Mokele Mbembe Handbook or Crypto Hunt on YouTube just automatically goes to the expedition.
All right. So again, people can get the PDF of that Mokele Mbembe handbook, and they can email you at wgibbons, G-I-B-B-O-N-S, at shaw.ca. And the YouTube channel is Crypto Hunt, C-R-Y-P-T-O-H-U-N-T, Crypto Hunt. What's the game plan then in January? I mean, what kinds of equipment are you taking over, and what's your strategy? What are you going to do differently this time that you haven't done before?
Great question there, Richard. Now, here's the interesting thing about the equipment. We believe that the latest breakthroughs in sonar technology, night vision technology, and even drones will make a huge difference. Now, the new Phantom 4 drone just came out, and we can use one of those to fly over the forest canopy, as well as around the area where swamps are and so on, and get great aerial shots and pick something up that way. Now, as far as the new generation sonar equipment is concerned, Hummingbird, which is a sonar company, brought out a brand new sonar unit with a 2D screen, and this shows everything up crystal clear in great detail underwater. Doesn't matter how murky or discolored the water is, because the rivers in Cameroon and Congo, they look like chocolate milk. They're very browny color. So using underwater cameras wouldn't be much good, but using the new generation of sonar brings everything up crystal clear, and you're able to record everything that the sonar picks up underwater, and it's a tremendous equipment. The other thing we need to do is to take an infrared camera. Now, night vision is great in Africa, but if something is moving in behind the trees overhanging the river, you can't see it, even with night vision. But if you use an infrared camera, the body heat of whatever animal is moving around in there shows up, and you can actually film and record with an infrared camera, and that would, again, be a tremendous, tremendous advantage. Now, one of the things that we are taking are the, do you know these game cameras where you just tether them to a tree and they take pictures of wildlife as they pass by?
Right, right.
We're going to take, I'm hoping, up to 50 of those, so we can just put them up on the trees and places along the river where the people tell us the animals are feeding. So we put these cameras in their protective cases in specific locations along the river systems and the swamp pools and everything else, and leave them there for 6 months to a year with the long life batteries. Then they will film and photograph absolutely everything that moves along the river, in the swamps, and other locations where we believe these animals are currently active.
Talk to me about how disruptive this would be if you were to come back with photographic video evidence of one of these creatures, and in fact it is an Apatosaurus.
Well, I mean, the whole world would be to pass through my front door, no question. But, you know, there's always the skeptics, and there's nothing wrong with having a healthy dose of skepticism. But if we come back with crystal clear video footage, and digital footage, I might add, of a, you know, of a Mokalian Bembe, and it turns out to be a living dinosaur, then people will accuse us of using Photoshop or manipulating the footage and so on. I mean, if I wanted to fake Mokalian Bembe, believe me, Richard, I would have done it 30 years ago. I wouldn't be soldiering on this long. But I think we're very, very close now, based on the location that we've found, and we're certainly in a much stronger position now to film something remarkable. But, you know, the scientists in the Western part of the world will always be skeptical. But one of the things I've found with this research is that scientists in places like Japan and China and South Korea and Russia are all very excited about this kind of research, whereas here in the Western Hemisphere, they are less so. So it's really down to us to not just bring back the evidence, but to present it in such a way that we can win the skeptics and the skeptical scientists onto our side and get them to become participants in what we're doing just for the furtherance of science and to learn more about these incredible animals.
Have you or your colleagues contemplated trying to capture one of these creatures, either alive or dead?
Well, we've asked the pygmies. They have only found them very occasionally dead. And we said, well, the next time you see a dead one, or keep something like a skull, a piece of bone, a tooth, whatever, something that we can have tested, you know, have a DNA profile done so that we can see exactly what it is we're dealing with. Now, if you're talking about a live Mokalian Bembe, if we can find another small stretch of river or channel or even a swamp pool where we know for sure the animals are right there, then we could find a way to dam both sides of a stretch of river or cordon off a swamp pool and pump the water out. And that way the animal would be much more exposed. It would be a little risky given the very aggressive nature of the Mokalian Bembe. But, you know, we're going to have to try something sooner or later to get the evidence that we need.
When we're coming up on a break here in a few minutes, what I'd like to, we can start this discussion now and then continue on the other side. But the Mokalian Bembe is just one example of what may be, in fact, a living dinosaur.
Right.
There are, of course, sightings of a flying creature in Papua New Guinea. And this is, of course, highlighted in your book, Missionaries and Monsters, that is described as resembling a pterodactyl or a pterosaur.
Right.
I believe there they call them ropen, R-O-P-E-N. But there are other examples throughout the world, not just, you know, the Congo Basin and Papua New Guinea. Let's talk for a few moments first about the ropen, and then after the break, we'll talk about some of these other examples of modern-day sightings, and then also we'll go back into the history books and talk about what were then described as dragons. Talk
right.
to me about the ropen, first of all.
Well, the ropen is an interesting creature. Now, there's two names in Papua New Guinea for these animals. One is called the ropen, the other one is duas. It means demon flyer. The locals there describe what sounds to be suspiciously like a pterosaur or pterodactyl in the old language. But now, these flying animals are nocturnal. and they have a exhibit a bioluminescent glow as they fly at night. And they are attracted to strong smells, whether it's dead fish or even dead people. They tend to try and dig up freshly tilled graves of deceased people to get at the body. I mean, it sounds very macabre. But we had exactly the same story from people in Kenya and Tanzania of a flying animal they call the Kongamatu. Again, described very much like a pterosaur, again with a bioluminescent glow, again it's nocturnal, and like the creature in Papua New Guinea, it lives in the caves up in the high mountains. But we know that a number of Westerners have seen the Ropan in recent years, including Paul Nation, who is an explorer who's been to Papua New Guinea and may be coming to Africa with us in January, and also Garth Gessman, Captain Garth Gessman. He is a captain in the Los Angeles Fire Department, and he's been going out to Papua New Guinea and bringing back some very interesting video footage of these nocturnal flying animals, which again sound very much like pterosaurs.
And these creatures, again, these pterosaurs, we're talking about an animal that supposedly died off some 65 million years ago.
Right. Well, again, so, you see, what's so intriguing about this is that there's a number of living forms with us today that were around during the heyday of the dinosaurs. For example, the Tuatara lizard in New Zealand, which is a very ancient reptilian form, was around before and after the demise of the dinosaurs. Same with the coelacanth, a very famous example of what they call a living fossil. Same with the horseshoe crab. Certainly with insects, bumblebees and ants and mosquitoes and cockroaches were all around during the dinosaurs, including other forms today. The crocodilian family was well advanced in the days of the dinosaurs, including sharks. So whatever it was that killed off the dinosaurs at large did not affect things like snakes and turtles and lizards, fish, reptiles, and so on. So it, again, in such a remote location, which is nothing but jungle and mountains and a very thin human population, it should not be so surprising that a relic species has survived, because every year we find dozens of new species, large and small, and mainly in areas of dense rainforest and jungle.
The Native American legend of the Thunderbird, is there a connection perhaps between that story and pterodactyls?
Well, if you want to find living pterodactyls, you don't necessarily have to go to Papua New Guinea. There's lots of reports of them in places like New Mexico, Texas, and Arizona, where they've been observed. In fact, I have a very good report from another researcher. About 10 years ago, two Mexican men were crossing the border into the United States at night, doing quite covertly. They were both brothers, and suddenly a gigantic flying creature swooped down and grabbed one of the brothers and hauled them away into the night. And it was described by the surviving brother as like a pterosaur, a gigantic wingspan, 20, 25 feet, leathery wings like a bat, a long beak filled with sharp teeth, and a protrusion, a bony protrusion at the back of his head. And
that sounds like a pterosaur for sure. Listen, we'll take a time out, Bill, come back and discuss living dinosaurs on the other side. Here's Three Dog Night and Shambhala on Coast to Coast AM.